Pushkin.
Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do. That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill-building courses for you to choose from because the steps you choose to take today will help you love what you do in the future. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Let's talk about psychedelics. It's been a few years since the FDA approved the use of ketamine to treat depression in certain patients. Later this year, the FDA may also approve the use of MDMA in combination with therapy to treat PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And researchers around the world are studying other powerful psychedelics like psilocybin and ibogaine and LSD. It's been clear for a long time that these are very powerful drugs. And it's becoming clear that these drugs may be particularly helpful in certain contexts. But still less clear is a very big, very important question. How exactly do psychedelics work? I'm Jacob Goldstein, and this is What's Your Problem? The show where I talk to people who are trying to make technological progress. My guest today is Gul Dolan. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of California at Berkeley. Gul's problem is summed up in a phrase from a paper that she co-authored last year in the journal Nature. She's trying to identify, quote, a common neurobiological mechanism that can account for the shared therapeutic effects of psychedelics. In other words, why do all these very different drugs seem to have similar powerful effects on the brain? Gul has a theory about this, about why all these different drugs seem to have similar effects. And if she's right, it could mean that psychedelics used in the right context may be useful beyond mental illness. Gul thinks, among other things, psychedelics may be able to help patients recovering from strokes. We started the conversation talking about the origin of Gul's quest to understand how psychedelics work.
About 10 years ago, when I started my lab, you know, there were starting to be some hints that psychedelics were having these remarkable effects in, you know, all kinds of diseases that didn't seem terribly connected to each other, right? So addiction and depression and PTSD. And, you know, the people who study those diseases each have their way of studying them and modeling them in an animal. And they're siloed into different spaces. And yet we were starting to hear hints that, you know, it didn't matter which psychedelic, they were kind of interchangeably showing some promise in all of these different areas that seem unconnected to each other. I mean, not just in terms of what behavioral assays we use, but even sort of what brain regions might be important, right? Like the depression people were focused on the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. The PTSD people were focused on the amygdala. The addiction people were focused on the nucleus accumbens, and they were just sort of all over the place. And yet there seemed to be this overlap. But when we then discovered that all of the psychedelics seemed to be doing the same thing, it sort of began to settle in that this explanation that we came up with could account for why all of these diseases that look so different from each other could be responding to psychedelics in a therapeutic way.
So should we start the explanation with talking about critical periods? Is that a reasonable place to start? Let's start with critical periods. What's the critical period?
Right. So critical periods are something that, you know, neuroscientists have known about for almost 100 years. They were first described in 1935 by Conrad Lorenz, who was describing an imprinting behavior in baby geese. So basically, 48 hours after they hatch from their eggs, they will imprint onto anything that is moving around in their immediate environment. So typically this would be their mother, but you know, if there's a crazy scientist around, it might be to the crazy scientist.
Right. And there are photos of the baby geese following him around, right?
In fact, as if
he were a mama goose. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, but that window of time where they're so sensitive to their environment and they form these lasting attachments only lasts about 48 hours. And then afterwards, they're not sensitive to their environment in the same way. They're not learning from their environment in the same way. And that window of time, Conrad Lorenz called it the critical period. And since that time, we've discovered literally dozens of other critical periods. So there are critical periods for rewiring the visual system, critical periods for touch, critical periods for movement, critical periods for language. Language is probably the one that most people are familiar with. If they try to learn another language when they were older, it's much harder and you always have an accent compared to the language you learn as a child. And so neuroscientists have known about these critical periods for a long time, and we've had this idea that maybe the reason that we're so bad at curing diseases of the brain, neuropsychiatric illnesses and neurological diseases, is because by the time we get around to correcting whatever is the underlying problem, the relevant critical period has already closed. And so the classic example of this is if you are born with bilateral cataracts in your eyes and you don't have them removed by the time you're age 5 or so, then you will be blind forever, because even if you remove the cataracts, once the ability of the visual part of the brain to adapt to the corrected visual environment, once the critical period has closed, it can't adapt again. And so even though the impediment is removed, the brain can't respond to it. And so you're blind forever. And so we have been looking probably for the last 100 years or so for ways to reopen critical periods, with the idea that if we could reopen them, we could potentially cure or do a better job of correcting some of these impairments later in life.
So in this Nature paper that you published last year, you write, it's tempting to speculate that the altered state of consciousness shared by all psychedelics reflects the subjective experience of reopening critical periods. Let me say, first of all, I like it's tempting to speculate. It's like you're not even speculating. It's more speculative than speculating, right? Like, we're not going to speculate, but we're tempted to speculate. So I appreciate that, right? Like, this is clearly speculative. It's based on research in mice. But why are you tempted to speculate that psychedelics may reopen critical periods in the brain?
Right. So the reason that we're tempted to speculate this is because, you know, one of the other things that brings together psychedelics as a group of drugs is that they all induce this altered state of consciousness. So we discovered a critical period in 2019 for social reward learning. It was a brand new critical period, although, you know, there was a lot of literature and from human studies suggesting that such a critical period should exist, but it just took doing it in 900 mice to be able to formally demonstrate it. So we did that. We showed that there's this social critical period. And originally, we showed that MDMA was able to reopen this critical period. And we thought, because MDMA is characterized by having this pro-social property that makes it different from the other psychedelics in that, you know, it's altered state of consciousness plus, you know, cuddle puddles and empathy, right? And so we thought it's because of that pro-social property of MDMA that it's able to open this social critical period. But then when we figured out that, well, LSD and Ibogaine and ketamine, none of which are like particularly pro-social. Nobody's, you know, doing a 30-person cuddle puddle on Ibogaine, right? Even though they don't have this pro-social property, they are all also able to open this critical period. And so that was our first hint that maybe the common property is between psychedelics that that accounts for this altered state of consciousness that they all induce is the common property of inducing critical period reopening.
And so specifically, can you just talk a little bit more about the specific critical period in mice that you're looking at here?
Right. So we're measuring something called social condition place preference, which is just an assay to measure the ability of the mice to learn from their social environments. And so that ability changes over time. And as they get older, they stop learning from their social environment. And so this developmental change relates to why we think teenagers are so much more susceptible to peer pressure than adults. We think it relates to why you're so much more sensitive to learning the rules of your culture when you're young. So, you know, you learn what's polite.
So it's basically the idea is that there's a there is some set of critical periods for learning social behavior, from language to norms, and those close over the course of childhood and adolescence.
That's right. Okay. And we think that that critical period, like other critical periods like language, you know, is curtailed as you get older, because basically it's sort of expensive energetically to always be having to learn from your social environment. You know, I like to think back on my teenage years, and, you know, mostly I'm relieved that they're over, because, you know, it was time consuming and energetically exhausting to, you know, have to care about the exact right shade of acid wash jeans that the cool kids are wearing, right?
And now you wear whatever acid wash jeans you want, right?
That's right. I wear mom jeans that are acid washed.
And so then you find that when you give psychedelics to an old mouse, they're able to...
The learning that they were doing in their juvenile period returns. So they're able to learn again like a juvenile.
Have you tested this theory on other critical periods in mice or on other animals?
Yeah. So basically, as soon as we got this result, I reached out to every single person that I know who works on critical periods. And I was like, do you have a critical period that you want to try and reopen? Because I think we might have accidentally stumbled on the master key for unlocking critical periods. And so we're working on it. We definitely have some collaborations going. But in the meantime, between sort of when we first had this 2019 paper, and then this summer, there have been some hints that other critical periods are being reopened by, say, ketamine. There are two papers showing that ketamine, if given back to back to back to back, can reopen the critical period for ocular dominance plasticity, which is this visual critical period that we've learned so much about the mechanisms about. So that's a first hint. And we are working feverishly to see if we can reopen other critical periods like motor learning for stroke. We're doing that in both mice and in humans. We're working on some language critical periods in collaboration with some other labs. So, you know, the jury is still out, but there's some other reasons to make us think that we're on the right track with this idea about the master key.
When you say master key in this context, exactly what do you mean?
So I guess what I mean is that when I was a graduate student, we were a little bit in a debate with another lab that was proposing that there would be some drug or manipulation that you could do that could reopen all critical periods, and that you could just give that drug and it would be the master key, right? And for unlocking all of these critical periods. And at the time, I remember being really skeptical of that idea. And I thought, well, anything that can do that to the brain is either going to induce amnesia, cause seizure, or disrupt the structural integrity of the brain. And I thought that because of what we knew about, you know, basically the mechanisms that constrain critical periods to these windows of time.
Like it couldn't work without breaking the brain. The only way to reopen the critical period is the master key is like a sledgehammer that's just going to totally break everything. So why even bother?
Right. And I, you know, I called it the melty brain problem. Right. And so then when we started getting these results for the psychedelics, I started thinking, well, how come we're not running into the melty brain problem? And I think, and this is at this point still speculative, and we are actively pursuing this line of research, so I don't want to overstate the case, but my hunch is that the way that we are able to circumvent, or the way that psychedelics specifically are circumventing the melty brain problem, is that they are context specific. So it's not that psychedelics are causing reopening of all critical periods everywhere in the brain all at the same time. It seems to be that they are not, you know, destroying or melting the brain, because they're only making available for modification the subset of synapses, circuits, memories, engrams that have been recently activated. And that is why they have this constraint of being context dependent.
So this is why your thesis is psychedelics will be helpful when paired with interventions like therapy, but not by themselves.
Well, this is the explanation we have for why the psychedelics aren't breaking the brain, rather than, I mean, basically the clinical data is driving this idea that, in fact, the context matters, right?
But it's a potential mechanistic explanation for that clinical
data,
I guess.
For that feature, that's right. It's a mechanistic explanation for a clinical description, which, you know, I don't think is going to be the case for every single application that psychedelics might be used for. So, for example, I think the critical period idea nicely explains why MDMA-assisted psychotherapy works. If we're able to demonstrate that we can correct motor impairments following stroke with psychedelics paired with physical therapy, then that'll be a nice other explanation.
I mean, that's a huge idea you just dropped in the middle of a list, by the way, right?
By the way, that's also quite speculative.
After the break, how Gul plans to test this hypothesis that psychedelics may help patients recovering from strokes. You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life. What are you doing now to help you get there? There are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP. That dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events. So it's safe to say it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Let's just talk about how we get from this sort of, you know, seems like psychedelics reopen one critical period in mice to like, can this idea be helpful in humans, right? You must know the aphorism, mice lie and primates exaggerate. I was thinking of that one.
I mean, I think that a little bit of why it's so hard to translate this stuff from mouse studies to human studies so far is that mostly what they've been used for is neuropsychiatric disease. And so it's really sort of impossible to measure or to recapitulate all of the features of a psychiatric disease in a mouse, right?
Like,
PTSD is mostly in humans and females, it's caused by rape. You can't really model rape in a mouse, right? And so there are all these other features of the illness that, you know, you can try and approximate by fear learning, but you're not really going to capture the salient elements. And so this is kind of why I think an important test case of this idea of the master key is to switch away from neuropsychiatric disease and move into neurological disease, because then, you know, we can explicitly test this learning model, right? If we switch to a neurological disease like stroke, and we're able to show that if we give psychedelics and pair it with physical therapy, we are able to restore motor learning. But if we give psychedelics and then just send them on home without any additional physical therapy, then nothing really is going to happen. That, I think, would be an explicit test of this idea that what the mechanism at work here is about learning and memory rather than a magic pill that corrects an underlying biochemical imbalance.
Well, yes. I mean, that's the side of it addressing this debate that you're involved in. But also going on there, presumably, if you're able to do this test in stroke patients, is if psychedelics plus physical therapy after a stroke leads to better recovery than physical therapy alone, that's great. I mean, I don't even care about the mechanism at that point, right? Like, is somebody going to do a phase one safety trial soon? Like, is somebody going to give stroke patients psychedelics?
We are working on it. Right after this call, I have a meeting to try and secure funding to make that happen. So we are on it, and we are actually doing it in parallel with mouse studies for mechanism. And, you know, I understand why people are so much more jazzed about, you know, the clinical outcomes and, you know, the real world impacts of these things. But I have to say, I think mechanism should not be underestimated as an important way of understanding this, because we never would have even come up with this idea of thinking about stroke if we hadn't thought of the mechanism, right? So if mechanism is what is leading us to speculate, if this mechanism is true, then these other diseases should respond in this predictable way.
There was a better way I could have framed that, and I apologize. I mean, what I really mean is, yes, it's useful and big to learn the mechanism, but like helping stroke patients get better is also a huge deal. Would perhaps
be a more
diplomatic way to say that.
I mean, I don't mind the undiplomatic way, because that's, I've been dealing with this right from the beginning, right? So the first time I presented this critical period idea at a meeting, it was in Portugal. And, you know, the room was full of people who were already doing clinical trials for psilocybin and for depression and MDMA for PTSD. And they were already very much invested in the idea that it was going to work based on some underground therapists' results, some anecdotal reports, some of their, you know, pilot studies. And they were like, why do we need mechanism? Who cares? We know it's going to work. And going backwards to look in mice seems silly. We know it's going to work. It's just a waste of time. And I said at that time, it was like, mechanism matters. And there are going to be a million different ways that we might fail if we don't understand exactly how these drugs are working. And basically, that prediction ended up being true, because the two people who were represented in that room were, on the one side, the people arguing for, you know, let's just use psilocybin like a next generation SSRI, and their trial failed. And then the other half of the room were people who were saying, no, we need to pair it with psychotherapy, and their trial was successful. And our mechanism, we think, explains the difference between them.
Is there an animal model you can use to test your hypothesis that in stroke patients, psychedelics plus physical therapy would work better than physical therapy alone?
Yes. So basically, one of the people I reached out to when, you know, we first got this critical period result for all of the psychedelics were two neurologists at Johns Hopkins. So Steve Zeiler and John Krakauer. And Steve Zeiler especially had been working on developing a mouse model of stroke. And what he has shown is that just like in human patients with stroke, right after the stroke, there is a critical period that gets reopened and some amount of physical therapy is able to restore function, but that is time limited. So in mice, you know, within 7 days after the stroke, they're no longer able to learn. In humans, that's a little bit longer. So, you know, in humans after your stroke, you're able to benefit from physical therapy for about 2 months. At about 3 months, it goes away. And that window of time, you know, it's closure, and people have thought about, well, you know, nobody has dreamed big that we might be able to reopen it, but people have tried to do other manipulations that might keep it open longer, you know, by enriching the environment, by, you know, giving them SSRIs, and none of those things have worked.
It's the injury of the stroke itself is inducing the brain to reopen the critical period that has been closed since childhood, and that allows people to whatever try and relearn language, try and relearn motor skills, whatever they have lost in the stroke, obviously not always successfully.
That's right. And basically, until this psychedelic idea came around, the most effective way to reopen the critical period for motor learning after stroke was to give another stroke, which you know, very therapeutically viable, right?
Yeah.
Like nobody wants to cure their stroke with another stroke. So this idea is testable, and we are in parallel testing it in collaboration with the Zeiler Lab. This is not a social critical period. This is a motor critical period. So let's test the idea that in this context, what matters is the motor learning or the practicing a motor task, not the social. And so we're testing that and combining with different psychedelics. So we're comparing all of those different conditions to test this idea in mice. And then in parallel, we will do the study to look at, you know, trying to reopen in humans.
And so the mouse study is underway now, and you're trying to get funding for the human study?
That's right.
And then once you have the money, then you go to the institutional review board and say, can we do this?
Yeah, you know, everything's queued up and, you know, everything is basically ready to go. We just need the money.
Non-trivial, but
it's a lot
probably surmountable.
I mean, it's a lot of money. We're asking for $1 million to run, you know, a safety trial in about 20 people. And then if that phase one trial goes well, the way the trial is designed is that it will allow us to collect just a little bit of, in addition to how well this patient population, right, because these are older people who have other medical issues. So we just want to be double sure that, you know, the drugs are safe in this population. But the way we've designed the trial is it'll give us some hints about efficacy. So we'll test, you know, a little bit of, you know, their ability to recover motor function. And the most important thing about the human trial and the reason that I paired up with Steve and John is because they have actually developed a sort of gamified virtual reality context for delivering this physical therapy. It's a virtual reality kind of room, and the cameras track the person's body position in space. And as they move their arm around, a dolphin on a screen moves around. And it's sort of a fun way to get people to practice moving, but it's also a little bit more play-like, which is more the way that we learn during our childhood. So there's this shift in the way we learn between childhood and adulthood from exploratory learning to sort of goal-directed exploitatory learning. So, and so we want to kind of mimic that as much as possible to make it fun and to make it not be goal-directed.
They're already doing that sort of psychedelic adjacent sounding thing where your arm is a dolphin and you're playing. They're doing that without psychedelics. And you're like, let's definitely add some psychedelics to that. I mean, is that not to be glib about it, but they're already doing that without psychedelics.
That's right. So they have developed that whole paradigm to test the efficacy of that sort of gamified environment compared to standard of care, because standard of care is really mostly just teaching patients how to use, say, the other hand to zip their zipper and brush their hand. It's really compensatory, not trying to bring back the lost motor function. And so they've done head-to-head studies of the virtual reality game version versus standard of care during that normal open state of the critical period. So right after the stroke, they've shown that there's better outcomes if they use this gamified version. And so now we're saying, okay, let's take all those people who didn't get the optimal therapy right after their stroke, people who had a stroke a year ago, and go back and see if we can reopen this critical period and then give them what we think is the better therapy in terms of this virtual reality.
We'll be back in a minute with the lightning round. You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life. What are you doing now to help you get there? There are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP. That dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events. So it's safe to say it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Okay, let's finish with the lightning round.
Okay.
What's your biggest professional disagreement with your mother?
Whether psychedelics can cure allergies.
Go on.
Okay. So my mother is an allergy and immunologist clinician. She's retired now, but you know, I've told her this crazy idea that we had about psychedelics, and she was like, no, that's not how it works. And the idea is based on the fact that, you know, there's some evidence to support the notion that allergy happens because, you know, the immune system, the part of the immune system that's normally supposed to fight off parasitic infections is being underutilized by our modern diets, which are more parasite-free than our evolutionary history. And so it's sort of left jobless and it's looking for a job. And my idea is that, well, maybe the brain is assigning the job and saying that dog barked at you. That's scary. That's the threat. Go after that immune system. And that if that's a learned association that the brain decided, that it could unlearn it too by reopening this critical period. It's totally speculative. I have to say, like, I don't believe it enough where I'm like out, you know, doing psychedelics and snuggling up to a horse. I would love to cure my horse allergies, but I don't believe it enough to go for it. I think it's a testable hypothesis that we should study.
And your mom believes it even less than you do.
That's right.
Yeah. What's your favorite portrayal of a psychedelic experience in, you know, in whatever, in a book, in a movie, in music?
I really still have a soft spot in my heart for the Huxley description of him staring at a chair, because, you know, as a scientist, I have to say that one really resonates. Like, I'm not a religious person, mystical experiences, that stuff doesn't really resonate with me, but his staring at a chair and sort of being mesmerized by the, you know, asymptotic distribution of chair molecules, the further away you get from the chair, and then the Huxley molecules, the further, and then, you know, the two of them sitting on each other and suddenly they're intermixed and Huxley is the chair. I mean, that resonates.
Have you ever taken psychedelics for work?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't really want to talk about that or answer that question.
Fine. Totally reasonable. Do you have any advice for people who are considering taking psychedelics recreationally?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, these are powerful medicines, and that we should honor and respect their power, and that they're doing something, if we're right, they're doing something very big to the brain, and that this transformation should not be taken lightly. And I would also emphasize that our studies suggest that once you reopen these critical periods, especially with psilocybin, MDMA, and LSD, they stay open for several weeks after the acute effects of the drug wear off. And so you're going to be in a sort of vulnerable state that's reminiscent of childhood. And I would say be very, very cautious about who you expose yourself to during that period. If you're in a traumatic relationship, it's probably a good idea to stay away from your traumatizer for a couple weeks after you've taken the drug. I think that we can learn a lot from the history of these drugs. Charles Manson is a good example of somebody who gave psychedelics to people and then used it to, when they were in this vulnerable state, which presumably lasted for a long time, to indoctrinate them into his way of thinking and turned a bunch of hippies into killers who were going to, induce helter-skelter to save the world. This is the sort of awesome power of these drugs that we need to be very mindful of and not treat them like little toys.
Anything else? Anything else we should talk about? I know you've got to go. I don't want to keep you, but if there's anything else you want to say, please.
I think we covered a lot. Super fun. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed
this conversation. Good luck getting that money.
Thanks.
Yeah.
$1 million.
Gul Dolan is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UC Berkeley. Today's show was produced by Gabriel Hunter Cheng. It was edited by Lydia Jean Cott and engineered by Sarah Brugger. You can email us at problem@pushkin.fm. I'm Jacob Goldstein, and we'll be back next week with another episode of What's Your Problem? How do you create present and future value? As a leading provider of specialized finance, operations, and technology advisory services for Fortune 500 companies, emerging growth market leaders, and private equity sponsors, cross-country consulting solves today's most pressing challenges and creates present and future enterprise value. With tailored, integrated solutions for accounting, risk, technology-enabled transformation, and transaction solutions, cross-country works as a strategic partner and collaborative part of your team. The future-ready business, insight and within reach. Go to crosscountry-consulting.com to learn more.